If you were going to paint a still life in 21st century America, what would you include? A bowl of fruit like you see in classical European paintings? Or is something else front and center in our kitchens today? Perhaps discarded roll-ups of plastic silverware wrapped in cellophane, paper bags, styrofoam to-go containers? If you edit these things out when snapping selfies with your phone, why are you doing that? Artist Yoon Mi Nam, who has a show up at Ha Contemporary in the West Bottoms, does the opposite, and we're going to hear about that now. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and Yoon Mi Nam is going to talk about making beautiful ceramic versions of all the disposable stuff we just ignore then throw away. Yoon Mi Nam, hello.
Hi.
Your show at the Ha is called For Now. Talk to me about that.
Well, I'm really interested in objects and objects that specifically when they seem to inherently have a sense of time that seems contradicting. So some of the items that are in the show currently are disposable objects and cut flower arrangements. And to me, they kind of seem to talk about the contradicting idea of time. And I always try to think about the title of the show that kind of suggests the idea of time in the work.
I want to quote from your artist statement. You write, "There is an ever-present yet always changing still life of a sort that occurs on my kitchen table." I think a lot of us can probably relate to that for better or worse, but go ahead and describe what you mean.
Yeah, so I started to look at my kitchen table as a site for kind of this unintentional staging of still life. Throughout the day, I think there are things that we handle, we kind of casually put down on the kitchen table, and we consume, and we, you know, read, or, you know, activities that kind of happen on the tape and on our kitchen table. And, you know, they kind of create this unintentional still life that, or sometimes maybe it's intentional, that kind of come and go throughout the day. So that in that whole process of things coming in and things leaving sort of also suggests that sense of time with these kind of daily and mundane objects that we are surrounded by all the time.
What are the kinds of objects that you're talking about?
For this show specifically, there's a lot of disposable containers, and, you know, often I have a lot of takeout dinners, and there are these daily mails that I bring in and just casually toss on the kitchen table. And I have somewhat of a daily sketchbook practice that I do on the kitchen table after I finish eating breakfast or dinner. Just items that kind of land on my kitchen table for a brief moment and then kind of clear it away. And so there's this constantly changing scenario that happens on the surface of the kitchen table.
So like takeout containers and piles of mail, those are the kinds of things that most people do edit out without even thinking about it for guests when they come over or when taking pictures. It is so universal, but it's something we don't usually put on display. And I mean, I see it as really this side of our lives that's so obviously part of everyone's life to some extent or another, but that we hide from one another.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting because it is something that we are all familiar with and we know so well, but we never actually carefully look at it as forms. And I mean, I also think it's just what these objects are, what represents our time in a way,
like how we spend our lives.
Yeah, the things that we surround ourselves with.
And then move out of view in some cases pretty quickly. You really dignify these objects in a way. There's one, I never thought I'd say this, gorgeous takeout container that you have glazed in this sort of like earthen way. And it's lined with gold powder where I feel like that's where the creases would be.
And I was kind of using the idea of kintsugi, which is a traditional Japanese method of mending broken pottery. And you know, I'm a newcomer in ceramics, so literally that was an accident that happened in the kiln. And you know, as I'm learning how to make ceramics, I'm just trying out a lot of different things and kind of highlighting some of the flaws, I guess, in some of the process that I have in my work.
Tell me about your background, your personal background first, and then we'll get to your artistic background.
I'm originally from Korea. I came to US in 98 to study painting and printmaking at Rhode Island School of Design. And since then, after I graduated, I lived in St. Louis for a little bit and finally moved to Lawrence, Kansas, where I teach printmaking at the University of Kansas. And then what was your other question?
Well, we'll get to the sort of artistic side of your background, but I am interested in this sort of like transnational piece of your experience because there also does seem to be a reference to that in a lot of your work. There is something of like a traditional Asian aesthetic that seems to be referenced. Like you'll see this single curved flower stem making an elegant line coming out of a vase, and then paired with these more contemporary symbols like the sort of carry out carton form.
Yeah, the kind of combining the traditional and contemporary is something that's always been part of my work. And you know, as a printmaker, I think that's something that is interesting for me because I also study traditional Japanese style water-based woodblock printmaking. So I do look at a lot of traditional woodblock prints and some of the works in the exhibition, the printed works, a set of prints that I have are done using that same technique. So, and the other printed works that I have that are of flower arrangements in disposable containers that are specifically the soda cups of different fast food establishments. Those also, I'm directly referencing the relationship between traditional and contemporary visually, because a lot of the flowers are tend to be black and white, which where I'm directly referencing the black and white woodblock printed imagery, the representation of traditional ikebana arrangements, and then the cups are rendered in a way that kind of follows more Western tradition of describing object with value and volume and, you know, this kind of dimensionality and color. So where the flower arrangement meets the dimensional cup, I guess I'm kind of hoping that there'll be a tension between the two. And also when you look at the image as a whole, it appears as if they do exist in the same space on my prints, but they seem to be existing in different kind of time and space.
Yeah, like they come from different worlds, but they've landed here together.
Yeah, and I guess that's what you're sort of getting at, that I sort of do see myself as those works as a metaphor for myself as a person and an artist.
You know, you referenced that the cut flowers, though, that they are sort of temporary in the same way that in a similar way that the takeout containers are, and that once you've cut the flowers, it's a ticking time
Yeah,
bomb.
very much so. In that, I'm kind of referencing both the tradition of Dutch flower paintings, which has a strong reference to the fleeting nature of time, and visually, I'm referencing the kind of flower arrangements that's done in the Asia.
So why did you move from talking about all of this in prints and two-dimensional art to trying to wanting to do it with ceramics so much so that you are teaching yourself how to do ceramics?
So, I think the way I work, it sort of, you know, I do one thing, and then another thing, and things kind of lead to a next thing, and so on. And I'm very familiar with paper as material, as being printmaker. So I use a lot of different kinds of paper. I understand paper. And one of the things that I did was I made a plastic bag, kind of a recreation of a plastic bag that, you know, has this generic thank you message on it, with this paper called gompi, which is a traditional Japanese paper, and it's very, very thin. And so I printed the thank you message with lithograph and then cut and glued to make it into paper bag. And at that time I was doing these kind of imagery of disposable object, and I just thought it'd be interesting to kind of see if I can make one of those with paper, which I'm familiar with. And when I made the bag, the problem was that because it's so light, it's almost like tissue paper, that I didn't know how to show this, because I didn't want it to become just an image. I want it to be an object that that exists in space. And just putting it on a pedestal, if somebody just walked past it, because it's so light that it will just, you know, blow away. So it was more from that problem solving, trying to figure out how I'm going to show this. I thought
to
about...
To show lightness.
Yeah, well, to show that the bag, I needed something heavy to hold that down. And that's when I started to explore other disposable objects and potential for creating these disposable objects using different material.
And that's a material very specifically, like when you think of something that's ceramic, there's something that feels so permanent about that. Like we find earthenware on archaeological digs of ancient civilizations. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And to see a styrofoam carryout container in ceramic sitting on a pedestal is jarring, even though this is an object that we see and you've made it look very faithful to the thing we see every day.
Yeah.
But it is jarring. You step back and really look at it in a way that maybe you've even avoided doing. I think I avoid looking at them because they make me feel guilty.
How so?
Because I'm filling up landfill.
Oh, yeah. I mean, ceramic as material, I think, like that kind of history is something that I was drawn to, because it has, as material, it has a different kind of sense of time inherently. It has this kind of history. And one of the things that I am starting to explore, and I used to do different materials, casting of different material. I've done glass, paraffin, and also plaster. And I try to kind of incorporate materials and the idea of materiality, and just selecting materials that to me seem to have certain kind of history to them. And I started to go more towards ceramic because of how much I can manipulate them while I'm working and when they're wet, so that I can start to combine them and put them together, which is what I'm starting to do in this show. And also, I started to, rather than faithfully recreating the objects, I started to experiment with different kind of glazes, such as some of the glazes that I used in this show are... For one example is Korean celadon glaze, which kind of references back to my background as someone coming from Korea.
It is very tempting to politicize these works or to see them as some kind of statement on single-use items in relation to the environment. I kind of hinted at that before. Is that mm-hmm. something you intend, or is it just there for us to consider kind of in the background?
You know, I do get that question a lot, because I think it is something that we are thinking about a lot. And it's not where it started. I didn't start making these works because of that reason. It was more because of just observing and thinking about the objects and materials that surround me, my everyday life. But I guess it does comment on it in some ways, because that is what surrounds us every day. all around us.
Yunmi Nam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yunmi's art is on display at Ha Contemporary in an exhibit called For Now. It's up through the month. I'm Gina Kaufman, and when we get back, the evolution and survival of species against the odds in the industrial waste of our cities. That's next on KCUR Central Standard. Wired magazine is about science and technology, with an eye toward what's changing, what's new. But the October issue on the stands right now features a story about nature, and that is because nature is changing. And not just in the distant Arctic or in the Amazon rainforest, it's changing in cities everywhere. The story is about how some species are evolving to survive the toxicity of urban settings. It starts with some fish in an industrial part of New Jersey. They have evolved on the cellular level to survive deadly chemicals in polluted waters they swim in. And scientists are starting to see this kind of thing in cities everywhere. The big question being, is this a model for human survival in the face of climate change? I'm Gina Kaufman, and the author of that article is with us now, Brendan Kerner. Welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
Oh, thank you for having me, Gina.
So start by telling our listeners about the Atlantic killifish in more detail than I just did.
Sure. So there's a section of Newark Bay, by the lower Passaic River near the big city of Newark. And right there for many years, there was a chemical factory that made Agent Orange, the notorious defoliant used in the Vietnam War. And as a byproduct of this process of making literally tons and tons of this poison, they pumped out these chemicals into the river and they flowed down to the bay. And these are called dioxins. These are horribly carcinogenic chemicals. And there was so many of these chemicals in the upper Newark Bay that in 1983, the state had to declare an emergency and start pouring literally billions of dollars into cleaning up the area. It's been cleaned up to some extent, but it's not a place you and I would ever want to go for a swim. It's still incredibly toxic, very hostile to most life. But there is a population, a very large population, of this minnowy fish called the Atlantic killifish. And they thrive all over in all sorts of waters. But the ones that thrive in upper Newark Bay, they're unique in that they're not affected by the dioxin at all. You take a killifish from any other place and you put them in the same environment in New Jersey, and they'll die, they'll fail to reproduce, the population will be wiped out very quickly. But these particular population in the waters of Newark Bay, they thrive. And so a particular biologist named Andrew Whitehead dedicated a big portion of his career to figuring out what it is about this specific population that has made them resistant to dioxin. And what he found is that this population has evolved a mechanism by which the pathway that is affected by dioxin is muted in these fish so that dioxin can't trick their systems into messing up development. And it's a product of evolution that happened very, very rapidly and really demonstrates how quickly animals can change on the genetic level in response to extreme stress.
So yeah, that brings us to the implications as you see them. You've written a really like thorough article that includes the stories of scientists and the particular research they're doing, but also a lot of real philosophical interrogation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got the idea for this story about how animals are changing in urban environments. I was actually at a Little League game. My son plays Little League near my home in Queens, New York. And I was talking to a dad who was watching along with me. And I asked him what he did. And he said it was a biology professor. And that's interesting and unusual for that environment. So I asked, what are you working on? He said, well, I'm going to a conference soon that's about urban evolution. And I started to think then, like, I don't really pay attention to the animals that surround me every day around my home in New York, the squirrels and birds and rats and lizards that are all over the place.
We'll get back to lizards.
We will.
I don't think of them as New Yorkers, but yes, we'll get there.
Sure. And I started to think about, well, how are cities, which we all kind of think about as non-natural because they're filled with man-made substances like concrete and glass and steel, how are animals that thrive among us, how are they doing it? How do they manage to live in places that are so unlike, you know, where their ancestors from centuries ago lived? How are they adapting? And that took me down this rabbit hole for months and months of finding this huge community of researchers who are dedicating their careers to finding out how the animals that live amongst us in cities are adapting to the environments we're creating as human beings.
You write the following: humans rarely give much thought to the creatures that flit or crawl or skitter about our apartment blocks and strip malls, in part because we tend to dismiss them as either ordinary or less than fully wild. But we should instead marvel at how these organisms have managed to keep pace with our relentless drive to build and cluster in cities. But I wonder, is hope what you feel when you think about these species that have managed to survive us?
It's a great question, because I think going into this story, I didn't want to have the story be felt as optimistic. I think the a priori assumption among all these biologists working in this field is that we as human beings have done pretty incredible violence to the environment on this planet, and that a lot of it's irreversible, and that we are going towards a future that's going to be hotter, more cluttered with human development and its consequences in terms of, you know, toxins in the environment. And the vast majority of species are not going to thrive in the environments we're creating. Only a small select percentage will. But I do think that by understanding how those animals are able to adapt, we can maybe make some educated forecasts, first of all, about how we can make smarter conservation measures. We can foresee which animals will not adapt well to the environments that we're creating. And we can also maybe take the animals that do thrive in human-built environments and kind of encourage their development to create a more symbiotic relationship with humans and make our cities more livable.
You write that the story of the pioneers of urban evolution are piecing together a story that is tinged with darkness. And I think you've just explained that to some extent, but it is sort of like you're describing a post-apocalyptic kind of landscape where, you know, the cockroach survives or something.
In some ways, I think there's a generational divide among evolutionary biologists. You know, for years and years, evolutionary biologists would focus on animals in what we would term exotic environments. They would travel really far to do their PhD research and their postdocs. And it was kind of accepted in the academy that if you wanted to, you know, to get tenure and get good jobs, you had to kind of work with these exotic, quote unquote, interesting animals that very few of us will ever see in the wild. But I think there's a younger generation, I'm talking about researchers in their 20s and early 30s, who've kind of accepted that the primary driver of evolution these days is human activity. And so we need to shift our focus to animals that are evolving in response to stresses caused by human activity, and not looking so much at you know, distant forests and savannas, but looking at the environments we populate every day and that we control through our building and the choices we make in our daily behavior.
Let's get a few more examples other than those Atlantic killifish, where we can already see this happening in cities in response to man-made challenges. Tell the story of the brown rat.
Yeah, sure. So the brown rat is the rat we all know and hate that crawls through our sewers and eats our garbage and all that. And so there's a researcher in New York named Jason Munchie South. He runs a lab at Fordham that's actually focused on urban evolution. And he's dedicated a significant portion of his last several years to studying this rat and trying to find out in New York, you know, what adaptations has the rat made to exist in the specific New York environment. So he's gone out and gone rat hunting many, many times, camped out in front of pizza joints at 1 a.m. trying to trap these critters. And what he found in doing genetic level analysis and comparing it to a reference genome that had been compiled as part of a federal project, he found that the olfactory sensors of brown rats in New York were unique, that there were certain
changes. That would be like their smelling tools in layman's terms.
Right, exactly.
Generally, nose. Go on.
Yes. So actually on the genetic levels, there's fundamental nucleotide differences in the genetic code for these noses, for these sensors within the nose. And what he determined, his big hypothesis, is that, you know, rats depend on their noses to navigate in subterranean passages. And the way things operate in New York is there's a kind of a characteristic New York smell. And so his hypothesis, which he's borne out in a lot of experimentation, is that, you know, these changes help these rats specifically to cope with the barrage of smells in New York and find their way in total darkness in these very, very tight passages that they're able to then, you know, navigate their way from one place to another in their constant search for food.
So that is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And they also then, like, closer to Kansas City, they think coyotes in Colorado have evolved to select for boldness. Mm-hmm. Because their survival relies on that trait in order to get close enough to humans to plunder our cities and farms for food.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We have to realize that behavior is also often genetically coded. And so boldness, having genetic, you know, predisposition to, you know, go out on forays for food really helps in an urban environment for coyotes. You know, coyotes generally are known for being so shy and trying to retire from humans when they see them, but that's not going to work in an urban environment. So
yeah, they're urban environments alone select on a hilltop.
Yes. So, but they select in cities to be able to go into places where humans will be close by, so they can principally look through garbage is where they obtain a lot of their food in cities. So you see this also in swans as well, black swans. They found that they also have a genetic predisposition to not be so scared of humans. There's a certain gene involved in dopamine that they found. And they, of course, if a swan is living in a park, they're going to be constantly surrounded by humans. And if they were constantly trying to flee, they wouldn't be able to feed, specifically because humans provide food for birds in some of those parks. So it really, again, those environments select for particular genes associated with behavior that helps those animals in urban environments.
It's sort of like Make Way for Ducklings, but the non-storybook version, like the genetic version.
Yeah, and there's a real distinction that has to be made between, you know, what's plasticity? What is, and that's what biologists call when a behavior comes about during an animal's lifetime and isn't passed on to the next generation. So the next generation has to learn it anew. And then there's also on the genetic level. And that's the real challenge for evolutionary biologists, is how do you prove an adaptation is genetic in nature versus something that's just a learned adaptation after birth?
So then closer to our listening area again, one of the stars of this emerging field is in St. Louis at Wash U. She studies roadkill.
She studies roadkill, but she's most famous. Her name is Kristen Winchell. She's actually most famous for studying lizards. Roadkill's a new thing for her, but she's most famous for doing research on lizards in Puerto Rico, a specific kind of lizard that thrives all over the island. And her work is fascinating because it concerns an adaptation that's visible to the naked eye. And what she found is that looking at lizards from rainforests in Puerto Rico versus the big cities there, the city dwellers had much longer limbs and thicker pads on their toes. And so she wanted to determine, well, why is that? What advantage or does that give the city lizards in their environment? And she actually built these home-built racetracks out of common Puerto Rican building materials. And she would hold these sprint races between the country lizards and the city lizards.
This is amazing.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite anecdotes from this. And she carefully monitored these, and she found that the city lizards always won, were just much faster on account of their limb adaptations. And her hypothesis is that this is because in an urban environment, lizards are exposed a lot. They have to skitter across, you know, vast expanses of concrete and asphalt, and therefore they're liable to be pounced upon by predators, particularly feral cats. In rainforest, there's tons of cover. They can always just go under a log or a leaf or something to get away from a predator. And so very quickly, you know, these cities have arisen somewhat rapidly over a matter of decades. They've developed this very noticeable genetic adaptation in limb development to make them much faster so they can avoid predation by cats and also cars and humans.
And it's, in that case, very obvious that it's genetic and not learned, because you can't just, like, get in really good shape and develop a bigger foot pad.
No, but it's interesting. You know, she did have to be careful about this because, you know, there are ways that bodies can change in response to stress. You know, think about bodybuilders. If you put a lot of stress on your muscles by lifting weights, of course, your muscles are going to get bigger. So she had to conduct which kind of the gold standard kind of experiment called a common garden experiment, where she took eggs of both the country lizards and city lizards, hatched them and then raised the progeny in completely identical circumstances, but completely isolated from one another. So a city lizard kid and a country lizard kid would be raised in identical cages, and then but kept apart from one another. And she did find that when they reached maturity, indeed, the city lizards did have those same trademark longer legs and thicker toe pads. So it was indeed a genetic adaptation.
But she is, so the same scientist is now in St. Louis studying roadkill. And I bring that up because you learned about that while on the road with a scientist who is studying pigeons.
Yes.
And she had to stop her car and get out and grab a dead raccoon to send to her friend.
Yes.
Which I love that this community, like you are really like witnessing a life among urban wildlife pioneers.
Yes, you are. That was a great moment. So that woman's name is Elizabeth Carlin, and she studies pigeons in the Bronx in New York. And we actually went out trapping pigeons and taking blood samples, then freeing the pigeons. And she then analyzes the blood sample. She's kind of doing 23andMe genetic analysis of pigeons from all over the East Coast to see how they're related to each other, and then trying to figure out what adaptations they've made to get used to city life. And we were driving back to her laboratory outside New York City, and we were going up a hill, and she looked back and she saw that there was a raccoon, and she said, well, I need to stop and get that for Kristen, who was her best friend, actually. And she said, she gave me a great quote I think I'll never forget, which is that, if you can't pick up a dead raccoon for your friend, what kind of friend are you? And I think I've tried to do it all
my friendships. I think that is a pretty good measure.
Yeah. I'm not sure if any friends I would pick up a dead raccoon for, so maybe I'm in trouble.
Time for a little soul searching.
Yes.
But so what's the deal with the pigeons?
So, yes. Yeah, so pigeons, amazingly, because they're so omnipresent in our cities, it's incredible how little we know about them, that they've been very seldom studied by evolutionary biologists. And I think it's because them being so common, we think of them as being ordinary and therefore unglamorous to an extent. And so this woman, Elizabeth Carlin, she joined the Fordham Lab dedicated to urban evolution, and she had to pick an animal to specialize in. And there's all these researchers there who look at salamanders and coyotes and mice and rats, and she had to pick one no one else had. And she picked pigeons, and she was stunned how little is known about pigeons in cities. For example, we don't really know how long they live on average.
Which is such a basic piece of information. What is the lifespan of this creature that lives right beside us?
Right. And so we know that about, you know, animals that live on the flip side of the globe. But we don't know about these pigeons who inhabit our cities here in the United States. We don't know how far they typically range from their homes throughout their lifetime in search of food. All these basic questions she had to answer. A big one she's trying to answer in her research now is, how do pigeons survive on these diets that are extremely high in sugar? Pigeons love discarded cookies, cakes, donuts. They eat that to a tremendous amount. Yet they don't get like diseases associated with overconsumption of sugar, like hyperglycemia. And so our hypothesis is that there's probably is a genetic adaptation at play. Kind of like the killifish we talked before, they've kind of muted this pathway that's affected by dioxin. Maybe there's a muted pathway in pigeons. They're not affected by sugar.
I'm Gina Kaufman, talking to the author of a mind-blowing story in the current issue of Wired magazine. Call 816-235-2888 if you have questions or observations about how various species, from microorganisms on up to rats and raccoons and pigeons, have evolved to survive human urbanization. 816-235-2888. Call now. When we return, a local guest joins the conversation. You're listening to KCUR Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about urban wildlife, how our cities have shaped the genetic evolution of the species that live in them. We've been chatting with a writer for Wired magazine because it's an article in the October issue that inspired our conversation, and we will get right back to him. But I want to hear a local take. Bill Graham is with us from the Missouri Department of Conservation. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. I want to back up and ask how you define urban wildlife.
I think urban wildlife is any place where wildlife shows up in your yard, in your business parking lot. Any place where people and wildlife interface is urban wildlife. And it could be wildlife walking into a small town neighborhood, or it could be wildlife that once in a while wanders into the heart of Kansas City. It could be...
I'm just picturing the setup for a joke like duck walks into a bar.
Well, you know, yeah, we have peregrine falcons, you know, nesting in the skyscrapers in Kansas City. But every once in a while, we'll get a young deer that'll get scared and wander into the heart of the city, too. So
what work are you doing with various species in our area living right among us?
Well, most of our work involves one of two things. First work is people want more wildlife in their urban neighborhoods, in their yard, or in their neighborhood, or in their park. So
intentionally. They want to intentionally draw wildlife to them?
They want butterflies, birds, and wildlife and habitat are intertwined. It depends on the trees, shrubs, grasses, wildflowers that you plant, what kind of wildlife you have, and whether or not there are islands of that habitat that's wild or semi-wild near your home or business.
So that's one piece of the work you do, is attracting wildlife to communities that want that.
And the second piece is the urban biologist who gives out advice, and actually all our personnel wind up doing this. What happens if you have wildlife that you don't want? And there's too much of it, or it's come into your house, or
it's
eating your shrubs.
So it's doing too well to the taste of humans in our environment.
Yeah, you know, like the beaver has adapted to suburban lakes and has taken a notion to chew down the pine tree that you've watched grow for 20 years. That becomes an issue. They can block some culverts and so forth, and raccoons that get in the attic, those type of things.
So let's go back to the peregrine falcons living in Kansas City skyscrapers, because that story is really interesting. And a lot of us who have followed the news in Kansas City over like decades know the story. But those who are just sort of newer to our community might not have any idea about this.
Well, peregrine falcons were endangered nationally in the lower 48, at least in most of the lower 48 and in Missouri. And for a couple of decades in Midwestern states, including Missouri, we've worked to put nesting boxes on the ledges of skyscrapers or up on towers at power plants and so forth. And it's been a great success story. These falcons have taken to these places and nested and produced young and are kind of fly all over the United States. They turn up, falcons that are hatched here turn up every winter down in Dallas, the same bank. And these falcons are out there eating on those pigeons that the researchers are looking at, too. They found a food source, and the pigeon that's plentiful in the city becomes meal for the falcons.
Interesting. So the pigeons are eating refined sugar in our discarded snacks, and then the peregrine falcons living in our skyscrapers are eating those pigeons that are surviving on our high fructose.
That's true. Kansas City, though, is a pretty green city with a lot of wild things around. So our pigeons may be getting a little grain dropped off at the grain elevators and the train tracks, too.
So they might have a better diet.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think of the ideas and research in this emerging field of urban evolution that we've been hearing about from Brendan Kerner at Wired Magazine?
I'm really excited by it for two reasons. One is science is just amazing these days. He's talking about some very technical things. I really congratulate him on well-spoken about very complicated things and able to express it, because science is in some very complicated, detailed frontiers. Anything that advances science probably advances our relationship with plants and animals in urban areas and wild areas. At the same time, I'm probably most excited by the fact that he's talking about awareness of nature in cities and suburbs. That's what the biggest frontier for nature going forward in the next century is going to be in cities, suburbs, farms.
Yeah, built environments.
That's right. Man is everywhere. So we are the biggest shaper of the nature around us.
Brendan, jump back in. Since that article came out, I wonder if you're hearing from people in cities with stories that didn't make it in the article, tales of urban wildlife, how species are surviving or not in particular places, how communities feel about that.
Yeah, I think the biggest response I've gotten from people curious about squirrels, actually, people seem to have some kind of almost mystical connection to squirrels around them and wanted to know what's going on with research into skills. And in fact, that's what Kristen Winchell, it's kind of her next frontier, is looking at these small mammals like raccoons and squirrels. So
Extensive squirrel coverage on this show, I'll have you know, but go on.
Okay, yes.
People can search our archives for that.
So I think that there is a lot of interest and awareness, like we're talking about, that people are realizing that, well, cities are natural. That it doesn't mean just because they have concrete and asphalt, they're not part of nature, and the laws of nature still operate. And I think one of my big points with that article was saying that you don't have to go to, you know, some place that's a forest or is devoid of human-built structures. You live in nature. Even if you live amongst glass and steel skyscrapers, the laws of nature still operate amongst you, and animals, wildlife operates amongst you.
Yeah, I mean, the idea being kind of too, like, we are also a species. So if a spider's web is nature, why isn't our skyscraper nature?
Right, and also just paying attention to the animals that you probably don't think about very much. One species I talk about in the piece is the humble acorn ant, which you probably rarely even see because they actually burrow into acorns and live in there, and that's a food source for them. But they are amazing creatures, and what they've done is they've genetically adapted to dealing with higher levels of heat in cities. Cities are warmer than their surroundings, so the heat gets trapped among the buildings. And these ants actually, we believe that they're manufacturing special heat shock proteins that make them able to withstand, you know, 4 to 5 degrees Celsius warmer conditions than, you know, acorn ants from the country.
Well, so we have some calls at 816-235-2888, people who have stories of particular wildlife they are interacting with in their built environments. And Kathy in Peculiar starts off with a question. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have an observation. I don't even know if we can call them wildlife anymore because we have so many Canada geese that seem to stay here year-round. But am I correct in assuming this is a learned behavior, that they are so bold about crossing multi-lanes of traffic?
Yeah, and that's in KCMO proper as well, that the geese totally stop traffic. And Bill, I'm going to turn this to you because you probably have answered a lot of questions about geese.
Well, I don't know if it's a learned behavior. It probably is. I know my geese story is being at a shopping mall, and there was a little square concrete island holding up a big light pole in the middle of the asphalt parking lot, and a Canada goose had made a nest on that little concrete island. So that's a goose that'll be removed and taken out to the wild somewhere and turned loose. But geese have adapted. That probably is a learned habit of theirs, is how to get along with people.
What are Canada geese doing staying around here so much?
We have a lot of water. They also like water that we have a lot of ponds, lakes, and we have a lot of urban, suburban ponds and lakes where the grass is mowed down to the edge. They love that because they can see if predators are coming after them. If it's clean shoreline, they feel pretty safe. They like it. And they can also munch on the grass that's growing out there.
Brendan, anyone doing fascinating research right now about geese in cities in America?
Not in particular about geese that I know of, but they're a fascinating species. I think their migratory patterns are changing in response to climate change. And actually, one thing I'm working on now, I'm working on a new story about how the proliferation of geese staying in American cities is actually presenting a new challenge for airports. Geese love to congregate around airports because of all the grass and water that often surrounds them. And of course, they're a hazard for aircraft. So I've been talking to a lot of biologists who are working on that problem right now.
Let's talk with Anne in Midtown, Kansas City. Anne, what do you want to tell us about?
Well, I want to tell you about a ground rat infestation that plagued my neighborhood for decades. I live in the urban core. Poisoning was ineffectual, trapping was ineffectual, and then there was a rout on Japanese honeysuckle in the local park, and that seemed to chase out some rat snakes into our yards, and suddenly the rat population just vanished. I mean, it was so dramatic.
And, because some snakes showed up, and the snakes showed up because of the management of what would...
I think so. I think that
honeysuckle?
Was coincidental. I think that they had been living in the park and were disturbed by the pesticides being poured on that honeysuckle and the chainsaws, et cetera, and they came into the nearby neighborhood because I'd never seen them before, but I saw some that were enormous, over 5 feet long.
Dang, and you saw a snake over 5 feet long in your urban neighborhood, and I'm guessing responses to that weren't, yay, they're here to catch the mice, or the rats, pardon
me? Well, it certainly was my response. The first time I sighted a snake, I saw it go from a tree into a neighbor's attic and just remove a squirrel infestation. So this was the biggest snake. But it really impressed me that they had been able to cope with dogs and traffic and lots of hazards. They don't move very fast, so a bad neighbor had no problem catching them and essentially torturing them to death. And when the protection agent from Missouri Conservation was called about that, he essentially gave that neighbor permission to do that.
These are
supposed to be protected animals, and they're so useful we should be seeding them into urban areas.
Let's hear what Bill Graham has to say about this.
Well, can I shift gears? I'd like to ask your other guest if he has any really interesting cases involving raccoons, because I personally have seen raccoons darting down into concrete storm sewers as if they're making homes in concrete storm sewers.
So, we can do that, but I do want you to first address what Anne has asked about, which are rat snakes in the urban core.
Well, the plant life dictates the wildlife. It's possible that the getting rid of invasive shrub honeysuckle in a park moves some snakes out, or perhaps they just showed up. We shouldn't be harming the snakes, though. The snakes are harmless, they're helpful, so people should leave the snakes alone.
So, okay, back to your question, raccoons?
Raccoons. Any wild stories with the scientists out there regarding raccoons in concrete storm sewers?
Not that particularly, but I did learn a great raccoon story from working on this piece, is that in the 50s and 60s, there was briefly a vogue in Japan for keeping raccoons as pets. And so raccoons are not native to Japan. They were, people would buy them and have them shipped over, and they would learn pretty quickly they're awful as pets. And so they would let them out into the wild. Now, as a result, there's actually a pretty sizable raccoon population in some Japanese cities. And scientists are starting to look at, you know, how those raccoons who have adapted to Japanese cities and trying to compare to how they're adapted to American cities and seeing if evolution has worked in the same way in both places.
Invasive species is the great challenge of the next century for all of
those
who deal with natural resources.
Mm-hmm. Spot on.
So, you know, Bill, what are some of the programs going on locally to sort of encourage the observation and understanding of urban wildlife in Kansas City?
We have a community biologist that works with the native plant group. He works with volunteer groups that plant trees. And these types of things, you know, encourage green space that people enjoy for scenery, but also can attract our friendly wildlife like squirrels and rabbits and butterflies and songbirds. And then we, you know, we offer a lot of help to people when they call with problems. We offer suggestions. If people have a nuisance wildlife in their house, we send them to the commercial nuisance wildlife guys because they're the professionals at removing them.
So, Brendan, for you, this idea of sort of bringing the green back into the city, that's one way of addressing some of the, like, non-hospitable ways that we've been evolving, but you're talking about really the opposite thing, that there are species that are evolving to survive the man-made piece of our cities.
That, and can also provide us benefits if we manage our human-built environments correctly. One example I talk about in the piece is oysters, that oysters used to flourish in all rivers. We should bring them back because they filter water, they get rid of toxins, and they can prevent storm surges. So let's take advantage of the fact that they can adapt to cities and bring them back.
That's all the time we have, but I want to just thank both of our guests for a great conversation. Brandon Kerner of Wired Magazine, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Brendan's article is out in the issue that's on the stands now, and you can talk to him on Twitter at Brendan Kerner or use the magazine's Twitter handle at Wired. And Bill Graham with us from the Missouri Department of Conservation, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
If there is something you missed, we will have both of this morning's conversations up online at kcur.org/centralstandard. They'll be there by the end of the day, and you can grab a link to share with your friends or whoever you know who might be interested. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, a food show with the critics. We'll hear about the best coffee shops and avocado toast in and around town. And hey, no hipster shaming. The people want to know. You can weigh in too. Tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Noah Taborda, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and Anne Knigendorf. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.